Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've been at this for a while, we humans, trying to build humanity into our machines, our features, our skills, and of course, our brains. Artificial intelligence. We've had decades of big predictions and dashed hopes, but still real progress. We've grown accustomed to robots building cars, computers beating us at chess, IBM's Watson acing a quiz show. And now comes deep learning, a surge in AI right under our noses. Right now, this hour on Point, artificial intelligence and deep learning. You can join the conversation. Do you see machines, software, computers getting smarter, doing deep learning? What's just cute and what's intelligence, AI? Are we ready for big progress here? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Archetypal AI moment, the 1968 Stanley Kubrick classic 2001 A Space Odyssey, the onboard computer HAL. Definitely AI, a red inscrutable eye watching over every aspect of the spaceship, every move the crew members make, brilliant, efficient, and ultimately a psychopath, but true blue AI as we imagined it.
Oh, HAL, do you read me? Do you read me, HAL?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, please, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
HAL? HAL?
Forever back to 1968 and 2001. It must drive the AI guys crazy. We've got a couple of top voices from that world with us right now. First, from New York, I'm joined by Jan LeCun. He's professor of computer science, neural science, and electrical and computer engineering at New York University, one of the top researchers in the field of deep learning. Jan LeCun, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And from Mountain View, California, and the headquarters of Google, we're joined by Peter Norvig. He is a director of research at Google, but that hardly captures his standing. Peter Norvig was NASA's senior computer scientist. He was at the heart of the early Google team. Google has staked a huge claim in AI, and Norvig has played a huge part in that. He co-wrote with Stuart Russell the university textbook on AI, Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach. I could go on. Peter Norvig at Google headquarters, welcome. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
So you guys labor away, and then suddenly, you know, somebody takes a look, and there's a big deal, and everybody's talking about AI. The latest thing we're hearing about on the outside in the layman's world is deep learning. Jan, what is deep learning in computer terms, AI terms? What's the excitement about?
So the excitement is mostly caused by the new results that have been obtained with this method. But the techniques have made big progress in the last couple of years. And the basic idea is to have methods that are a little more inspired by neuroscience and by biology than the rest of AI, and perhaps take a bit of, you know, try to emulate the capabilities of that our brains have to learn, not just human brains but also animal brains.
We've heard a lot about big data and the part that it plays in this. What's the connection between big data, these massive new high speed access to tons and tons and tons of data, and this deep learning advance in AI, Jan?
So there, you know, big data is a big hot topic right now, and there's a lot of techniques are used to analyze gobs of data. I'm sure Peter can tell us a lot about that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a lot of machine learning techniques that have been used in the past to analyze this data. What's special about deep learning is that it makes it a little easier to build a learning system. It requires a little less human intervention, if you will. It has a good chance of working quite a bit better, and it also strives on very large data sets. And so, although some of the methods have been around for a while, the reason we hear about it now is that the data sets are becoming big, and those deep learning methods are able to take advantage of it. Also, we have very fast computers now that we didn't have a few years ago.
Access all that in a hurry. Peter Norvig in Mountain View, I know some of your team, Andrew Ng and Jeff Dean, have done a lot of work with neural networks. We'll get to some of what this enables, what kind of capacity this brings out. Jan says there's some exciting stuff there. But help us understand the architecture of this: neural networks, big data, deep learning. Flesh these out for us a little bit, if you would, Peter, further.
Okay. By neural networks, we mean two things. One is that it's inspired, in a way, by the connections in the brain. But we aren't really trying to duplicate the brain at this time. We're just trying to say, what can we borrow from what we know about that and apply it to the computers? Because a computer is very different than the brain in terms of the amount of storage it has, the speed at which it operates, and so on. And I guess the big difference that Jan alluded to is this change from saying the way we're going to program computers is not to sit down and think hard about it, which is what, when I was in graduate school in the 80s, the idea was you got a bunch of cheap labor, graduate students, and had them think about the world and try to understand it and then write it down in the kind of formal mathematical notation that a computer could understand.
Sort of to make them model on the human brain somehow, broadly?
Not necessarily, but just try to get them to do the right answer.
Okay.
And we soon found that that was just too hard, that the world is so messy and confusing and there's so many things that you can't just think about it and write it down, because you'd never get to the end and you'd start contradicting yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the more recent approach says, okay, if we aren't smart enough as people to understand the world and write down a description of it, maybe the world itself is the best description of itself. And we have so much data available now. You look at all the text and the images and the videos that are available on the internet. So now with the approach to say, let's not teach the computer by telling it rules. Let's teach the computer by showing it examples and making it learn its own generalizations from those examples.
Is that pattern recognition off of all that big data, Peter? Is that what that is, or something else?
That's right. So we want the computer to recognize patterns, and we think of it in terms of two tasks. First, we want it to bring out the patterns from what it's already seen. So you show it a bunch of pictures and say, what is this picture? Is it a person? Is it a car? Is it a flower? And you want it to get those right. And then you want it to be able to generalize, to be able to see a picture that it's never seen before and say, I've never seen quite this, but it looks like a flower.
And for a computer to do that, whether it's a flower or a cat, is a big deal, to be able to see an image and identify it.
That's right. It's a big deal because there are no set rules of, what exactly is the boundary of what any of these things can look like. And what's exciting about the recent years is this deep learning approach. And by deep, the way I see it is that it means hierarchical. So rather than going kind of directly from a picture to an answer, I see this picture, I say, this is a person. Rather, we can go hierarchically in steps. We see this picture, we can say, I see this has a body and a face. The face has an eye and a mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The eye has eyelashes, and so on. And we have representations of what we see at each of those levels. And so the deep is going up and down through those levels.
Put all those together, and you may be identifying a human being. It's almost a kind of computation, looking at all the elements and coming
That's
up.
That's right. It's a computation. Now, the reason this computation has been difficult, and it's taken us so many decades to get here, is because if we want to do it by showing examples, we want to be able to recognize right from wrong, right?
And accurate from inaccurate.
And it's easy to go the full step. You know, you can go on the internet and say, find me all the pictures that have the word cat in the caption, and somewhere in there, there's probably going to be a cat. So now we have a label of the right answer. But what we don't have is a label for all the intermediate pieces. I mean, nobody goes in and says, they put on the picture, this is a cat, but they don't say, this is the
furry thing
right
with a tail and this kind of paw, and on it goes.
Right. Right. So we had to come up with ways for our computers to kind of invent those intermediate categories, even though we haven't seen examples that are labeled correctly for them.
Do you call all of this artificial intelligence, Peter?
You know, we call it a lot of things. So yes, artificial intelligence. You mentioned pattern recognition. We call it that. You can call it statistics. It all depends on where you went to school and what you got your degree in.
Right.
But in the end, it all comes together.
And Google is all about making applications and having people do stuff with these things. I mean, do you see a much smarter world of computers, therefore internet, coming at us through this kind of advance, Peter?
Yeah, I think we're getting smarter all the time. You know, we see that in the applications that we offer. We keep measuring and we keep making improvements. So we're doing better at what we do, and we're also extending the range of what we do. Because the way people want to use their computers and their devices is extending. You know, when Google started, it was all about sitting down at your desktop and typing on a keyboard a few words and seeing a list of links. Mm-hmm. And we still do that and spend a lot of time trying to get it right. But we also see people that are on the go and using their phones and maybe taking a picture with their phone of something and wanting to recognize what that picture is. And so there's much more of a direct connection with the world and new types of media other than text. And we have to continually keep up with that.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about AI, artificial intelligence, on the move again, seeping into more and more of our lives. The latest buzz is around deep learning and machines doing it. Jan LeCun is with us from New York University today, a top researcher in this field of deep learning. Peter Norvig is with us, big research maven at Google, early central player there, co-author of Artificial Intelligence, A Modern Approach, the kind of textbooks to this whole AI region, and still very much engaged in this at Google right now. Let's look at a little bit of then and now fiction and very real world. Here's another. I mean, again, Hollywood just has not been able to get enough of this over the years. Here's from the Steven Spielberg's 2000 film AI. An 11-year-old android played named David, played by Joel Osment, believes he's a human being. And here's a pivotal scene where David, the android, finds himself face-to-face with a duplicate copy of himself and realizes he is not a human.
I'm David. You're not.
Yes, I am. I'm David.
So am I.
Hello, David. Can you read? Can you sit down and we can read together? Let's be friends.
Two Davids, androids meet, it's all AIs, no humans required. Of course, that's Hollywood. But here, from just last month in Tianjin, China, is a little sound of a real-world application that got a lot of attention. Microsoft's chief research officer, Rick Rashid, wowed an audience in Tianjin when he showed off the potential of deep learning and the next step in voice recognition. He spoke to the audience in English, and in a matter of seconds, you'll hear, Microsoft's computers turned his voice into English text, translated that into Chinese text, turned the Chinese text into spoken Chinese, then rendered it in his voice patterns. Listen to this.
There's much work to be done in this area. But this technology is very promising. And we hope in a few years that we'll be able to break down the language barriers between people.
You can definitely hear the enthusiasm of the audience there in Tianjin, China, as the Microsoft researcher rolls out their latest. Google's rolling out a lot. In Jan LeCun's world, there's a lot being rolled out as well. Jan, you were talking about recent results from deep learning that have people excited. I wish you'd walk us through a couple of those. What are you seeing that's got everybody's attention?
Well, so the first one is the one you just mentioned, which concerns speech recognition, and it's been a very interesting story because the technique went from sort of blue sky research in universities to deployed systems by the likes of Google, Microsoft, mm-hmm. Nuance, which builds the speech recognition systems for the iPhone.
Yes,
in a very very short time, in just less than a year or so. IBM is also embarking on this and other companies. And so so that's sort of the most striking results that people can see and play with. There have been other success in other areas, particularly in image recognition. Those are not deployed yet. There are sort of lab experiments.
Okay.
But they're extremely promising and will probably result in practical applications very soon. There's also other applications. There's a kind of a stunning result recently by Jeffrey Hinton's group at the University of Toronto in an application to try to figure out if a particular drug would stick to a particular molecule in the body.
This was sponsored by the big pharmaceutical company Merck.
And, Merck, exactly.
Okay, and explain what happened in the deep learning sort of model that we see in it.
Well, so actually, the details of that model haven't been released yet. The results, we know the results, but we don't know the details of the techniques that haven't been published yet.
Well, in broad stroke, I bet it will still seem like a model to me, even if it's not a technical model. How did it work?
Let me take a simple example of how deep learning works. Perhaps the simple example I could take is for recognizing letter, right? So we've all played with optical character recognition systems or yes. things like that, or handwriting recognition systems.
Yeah.
So imagine you want to write a program to, say, recognize the letter T. So what you're faced with is an array of numbers. Maybe it's zero if the corresponding pixel is white and one if it's black, let's say.
Okay. Yep.
So you have an array of numbers, ones and zeros, and now you have to write a program to detect that there is a vertical bar and a horizontal bar. And you could write a program for this, but it wouldn't be very robust because if the T is drawn in a slightly different way, if it's if it's handwritten in a kind of funny style, it would be very difficult for the program to be robust to that. And so... So what people have done over the last 50, 60 years or so, since the beginning of AI, is you write a program that doesn't do the entire job. It sort of turns this array of pixels into a list of attributes, if you want.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can write a program to, say, detect a vertical bar or horizontal bar, you can say, well, in this image, there is a vertical bar and there is a horizontal bar, and maybe I can tell that the horizontal bar is above the vertical one, and maybe there's a junction between the two bars. So you could sort of write little programs that extract attributes like that. And then you take this list of attributes and you plug it to what's called a machine learning algorithm, which will learn to classify, to tell you, it's a pattern recognition algorithm that you can mm-hmm. train using examples of T's and examples of other letters. And it will tell you whether it's a T or not eventually. The problem, of course, is that in this step, you have to build this little programs that extract those attributes. We call them features. What's new in deep learning is that part of the system is also trained, and so we don't need to build it by hand anymore. We just show the image, and we train the entire system, and it figures out that what's important to recognize a T, is to be able to detect horizontal and vertical.
Wow,
bars.
That's a lot of independence if it can do that.
Right. And so, it's difficult for handwriting recognition, but in fact, the first applications of deep learning go back to the early 90s, mid-90s, precisely for that application for reading checks. Back when I was at Bell Labs in the 90s, I have built a system like that eventually was used by banks to read checks automatically.
So it could be letters, or presumably it was molecules in the case of Jeffrey Hinton's work with the molecule they're looking for Merck, or it could be... People are talking faces. If it's law enforcement down the road, I mean, this has sort of unlimited applications, doesn't it?
Right, and those applications already exist. It's just that deep learning allows us to build more of them faster, and they will presumably work better.
Jan LeCun, please stand by in New York, and Peter Norvig in Mountain View, California. We've got a call coming in here from Mumbai in India. Jai Dev is calling. Jai Dev, thanks for calling from Mumbai. You're on the air. What's your question?
Hi, Tom. Hi.
So, I have a question for both Jan and Peter.
Good.
Hello?
Yes, good. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. Go ahead.
Oh, great. So my question is, do you believe in the singularity? Or basically, do you believe in the entire Ray Kurzweil school of thought? That one day machines might become smarter than us?
Singularity, Ray Kurzweil, machines outpacing us. Peter Norvig, I'll take that question from Mumbai, India, and give it to you. What do you say?
Okay. So the idea of the singularity, a singularity is a single point beyond which you can't explore or understand anymore. And in Ray Kurzweil's and other people's analogy, this idea is that technology is accelerating so fast that we'll soon reach a point where we won't be able to say what's going to happen on the other side of it. And this will in part be driven by computers that are so smart that they can design other computers that are even smarter, and who knows where that will lead. I certainly believe that computers are getting more capable and are doing more things. And in many areas, computers already outpace what people do. If I wanted to multiply a couple of 100-digit numbers, I'd
right.
ask a computer to do that,
mm-hmm.
not a person.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to find the right web page out of a trillion web pages, a computer would be better at retrieving that. But if I wanted to write an essay on what one of those pages meant, at the moment people are still much better at doing that than computers.
So I see it
more as a partnership to say, what is it that computers can do really well, and let's let them do that. And what is it that people do well, and let people continue to do that and use computers as their tools.
And look down the road. Jaidev is looking down the road from Mumbai. Ray Kurzweil looks down the road. I mean, where do you see this headed? How much of what humans can do can you imagine ultimately being done by computers in terms of thought?
You know, I think we'll see more and more. Ray Kurzweil has a great record of predicting the future, so maybe he's right. I just think there's a lot of uncertainty that we don't know where we're going to end up or how fast we're going to get there. We've seen great upheavals in the past due to technology. You know, it used to be in the United States more than 95% of the people had jobs as farmers. Now it's somewhere under 5%.
Mm-hmm.
So we've completely changed our mix of what we do. And I think we'll see that again. We're in the middle of another revolution, an information revolution. And, you know, we've talked about it being here for decades, but I think it's just getting started.
As all kinds of new applications and capacity come on stream, from this world. Let's get a call from Mech in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Jaidev in Mumbai, thanks so much. Mech, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a question and a suggestion as well. I'll start with my suggestion. The suggestion is, you know, we have progressed pretty fast, and I would like to see some kind of a control on all this artificial intelligence because, you know, I'm pretty sure that they'll outpace us pretty soon, and if this is not being regulated, I feel like it's going to be an issue pretty soon. And the question I have is about, is there like a central intelligence unit or like a central AI that controls all the information that's coming in through the internet and kind of, you know, makes sense of that? Similar to the Eagle Eye movie. I don't know if you know it.
I don't.
But, okay, it's a similar movie where, you know, an artificial intelligence computer controls a lot of things, and it's pretty scary, and that's all I wanted to know, and I'll get my answer off the air. Thank you, Tom.
Mech, thanks for calling. Jan LeCun, what about LeCun? We've seen this in lots of Hollywood work, but you know the ultimate lesson from Hollywood is be afraid, be very afraid of AI. How do you
right,
look at
starting,
it?
Right, starting with AL 9000 in 2001. Actually, I was very much inspired by that movie when I was a kid. I watched that movie, you know, when I was 9 years old, and it.
And now here you are, the big life. AI guru. Okay,
right.
So.
Yeah, that's ironic. I don't mean to build crazy AIs. No, none of us do. In fact, we're very, very far away from doing this. You know, I'd be happy if in my lifetime I build something as intelligent as a rat. I hope Peter would pardon me for this, but I was a couple of months ago. I was in a debate, a panel discussion, and we said that you know, Google is the closest thing we have to an AI because of, you know, it gets a lot of information from the web, and people from the 50s would probably see Google today as an AI system. And then in the same sentence, I said, you know, I'd be happy to build something as intelligent as a rat. And so immediately it was picked up saying, you know, Google is not as intelligent as a rat.
Right.
And it's partly true. So it's partly true in certain ways and not in other ways. So there are things that are extremely easy for humans and animals to do that we don't realize require a huge amount of computation and intelligence. Mm-hmm. And vision is one of those things. Vision takes up about a third of our brain, or about a quarter of our brain in humans, and is true of many animals as well. And so mm-hmm. we devote a huge amount of resources to do vision, and we don't feel that effort. But in fact, it's you know, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do for our brains. You know, what we can do with computers at the moment in vision does not come even close to what a rat can do. So we're very far from building the sort of all-encompassing, you know, controlling AI that will take over the world. Not even close. I don't think, you know, any of us here around this table will see this in our lifetime. You know, the one way we can try to estimate this, coming back to the singularity question, is you know, making a very quick calculation. We have about 100 billion neurons in our brains.
Okay.
That's a one with 11 zeros. Each of those neurons makes connections with about 10,000 other neurons through those contacts, the synapses. Mm-hmm. And when we simulate neural networks, those synapses are essentially the things that need to be computed.
They right.
need to be that require computation, if you want.
Okay.
And our brain can do about 1,000 computations from each of those synapses per second.
Wow.
So if you kind of multiply all those things together, you realize our brain can do on the order of 10 to the power 18 computations per second. That's a one with 18 zeros.
How close can computers come to that?
Well, so the whole argument about singularity is that if you extrapolate Moore's law, mm-hmm. we might get computers around that power, you know, within the next few decades, maybe 50 years or so. The thing is, you know, those computers will still occupy a big room, and then 10 years later, they will, you know, fit in a fridge-like.
That sounds like we're on
rack.
Our way to the singularity. 50 years is not that long.
Yeah, except there is a big question, which is that we have no idea how to build a machine like this, or to program it, or even using deep learning in such a way that it would be as intelligent as humans, you know, let's say a rat even. But it would be nice to have, you know, if we had a system that could do vision as well as a rat, we could use it to help us drive our cars and things like that. You would think that it requires intelligence to drive a car, but to kind of avoid obstacles, you know, rats can do that just fine.
Peter Norvig, is Google smarter than a rat, Peter?
I agree with Jan that Google is a kind of a combination of superhuman performance, kind of an idiot savant or Rain Man in some areas, and then sub-rat performance in other areas.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about artificial intelligence, AI, on the move again, seeping into more and more of our lives. The latest buzz is around deep learning and machines doing it. Jan LeCun is right in the middle of that at NYU. He's with us today from New York. Peter Norvig is right in the middle of it, top research mind at Google, with us from Google headquarters in Mountain View, California. You'd better believe they're looking for all the applications they can find on this front. Peter Norvig in Mountain View, look ahead. Where are we likely to see more palpable applications of this that people find in their lives, whether just out and about or at work in the, I don't know, near years?
So I think Jan explained it well in saying that what deep learning gives us is the ability to understand complicated features of the world that would be difficult for a human programmer to come up with. And so you'll see advances in areas that are difficult to understand and talk about, like computer vision, like speech recognition. Mm-hmm. You know, we all can recognize speech, but we can't really describe how we do it. And so it's hard to describe to a computer how to do it. And the deep learning approach allows us to learn by example rather than to learn by programming. And so I think you'll see more of that. Areas like machine translation, we've done a lot of work on, and we do that all by example. We don't try to teach our computers, this is the dictionary of English or French or the mm-hmm, grammars.
Right.
Rather, we just say, here's an example. Here's a sentence in English. Here's a corresponding sentence in French. Give the computer a few billions of those examples, and then have it learn how to make that connection.
And what about out and about, Peter? I mean, you guys at Google are big in self-driving cars. How does AI come in there?
Yeah, that's right. So that's one of the experiments we've been working on, not a product yet. But there the idea is we need to understand where the car is, what's around it, and keep it on track. And part of that is driven by the investment we've already made in having very detailed maps of the roads, so we can identify where we are with respect to the map. Mm-hmm. But of course, things change all the time. Both in terms of there may be construction, so the road has changed, and there's always pedestrians and other cars. So we've got to learn on the fly as well how to recognize those types of objects and recognize what they're doing.
Vision involved there. There's been a lot of attention in Hollywood over the years to facial recognition, but law enforcement seems to be really looking at this now. Jan LeCun, what about facial recognition and the growing capacity of computers to sort of keep an eye on who's where when?
Well, so it turns out face recognition is sort of a bit of a separate field that uses its own technique. It's kind of a subfield of what's called biometrics, mm-hmm. where, you know, people can recognize faces and fingerprints and you know, irises and things like that. And those are sort of a different set of techniques to some extent, because the problem there is to recognize particular objects instead of general categories. So it turns out to be slightly easier for a computer to recognize a particular object. So let's say you have a particular magazine cover or a particular a type of car, you know, viewed from the side, or okay. a particular person viewed from the front. You can essentially match a template. If you have an image of that person and you have a nice frontal view, you just match it to the image of the person you already have in your database and compare it. And you can do this if the objects don't vary a lot, you know, within a category. But if you want a system, for example, that recognizes, you know, tells you if the object in front of you is a chair. Chairs appear in many, many different shapes and yes. forms and things. And so it's very difficult for a computer to learn what really makes a chair a chair. It's not any particular detail that are attached to the shape of the chair. So that's one of the problems. So what those deep learning techniques are good at is those kind of categorical classification. You know, is it a chair? Is it an animal or a
right? Running through lots and lots of comparisons. I've got lots of listener response here. But one third way writes to us, says this sounds like brute force statistical recognition, which does have its place, like those brute force chess playing computers. But this approach, she writes, will not necessarily lead to an understanding of how we and animals do the things we do. Is it necessary to figure out how, let's say, animals, never mind humans, do think the things we think in order to replicate them, Jan?
No, it's not necessary, but it gives us inspiration. So perhaps the best analogy would be to draw a parallel with the early days of aviation. You had, you know, very smart engineers who would try to build airplanes, and then you would have people trying to understand the laws of aerodynamics. And a lot of those people got inspired by birds. Birds are kind of an existence proof they can have heavier than air flight. And so there are people actually all around the world, in Europe in particular, who built airplanes that looked like birds or like bats, mm-hmm. actually. And one of the first airplanes to take off actually was bat-shaped. It was uncontrollable. Nobody remembers it. But,
yeah.
you know, it was too much inspired by biology to some extent. It was trying to stick to biology too mm-hmm. much without really worrying about the sort of principles that controlled flight. So eventually, you know, with a combination of experimentation and theory and creativity, people figured out why birds and planes can fly. It's basically the law of aerodynamics.
Even though so planes didn't after, look like birds exactly, but they still fly like birds, fine. You know? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So, and you know, if you were a bird biologist and you would talk, you know, if a bird biologist were to talk with a airplane engineer, the bird biologist would say, there's no chance your airplane would work because if you look at how birds are complicated, you know, their feathers and feathers right. are incredibly complicated. And, right. you know, I look at them at a microscope and, you know, I have all those information about details. You have to reproduce all those details. Otherwise, your plane is not going to fly.
On that front, if I may, Peter, here's a listener who says, you know, if a machine intelligence were to develop, would we necessarily even realize it? The thoughts and actions of a computer could be so alien that true machine thought may resemble nothing like what we are testing for. This seems to kind of take off from where Jan is. What do you say to that, Peter?
Yeah, I think we don't really understand what the word thought means. You know, we have an intuition of what we're doing and that that's thought, but we don't really have enough other examples of thought to figure out what the boundaries are. And so it's hard to say if what a computer is doing should count as thought or not. And I think over time we'll probably come to a better realization of these deep questions of what is thought, what is consciousness, and so on.
Our listeners are really thinking about where this goes and how we seed this future. I mean, maybe have seeded it already, but William writes to us, he says, despite my support of future technologies, I recognize that our current economic system and social norms are insufficient to deal with what's coming here. He says, remember, soon machines will be taking their cues, he writes, from the power elite and the statistical norms created by the masses, big data. We'd better start thinking, he writes, about providing initial models from which future AI systems will be using to form their starting points. What about that way of looking at this, Peter, about the sort of kernel at the heart of all this as being important, the model at the middle of it, to where this goes?
I think it is hard to predict where everything is going, although I do see a trend where yes, it's true that technology can accelerate the lead that the elites have or that powerful governments have and so on. And you definitely see some of that. But you also see it accelerating the power of those farther down the scale. And, you know, and you've seen that in the Arab Spring and so on, where having mm-hmm. access to technology certainly made a very important difference for the less powerful. And I think that the trend seems to be more in that direction. You know, we went back to 2001. And there, you know, the model of what a powerful computer was like in those days was the mainframe computer. And if you remember when astronaut Bowman had to turn Hal off, he went inside a room
right.
that was Hal. So
right.
Hal was room-sized.
Yes.
Now, when you think of a typical computer, you think of something that fits in your pocket that you carry with you. And that is a tool that you use rather than something that's room size that a corporation uses.
But we also think of the cloud and some gigantic server farms somewhere over the horizon. There's still scale out there somewhere.
That's right. That's right. So it's a mixture, but I don't think it's going all in one direction of favoring the powerful. I think, you know, rising tide lifts all boats.
We'll see. We will see. George in Portsmouth, Virginia. George, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing, Peter?
Very, very well. What's your thought, George?
Well, first off, I'm 78 years old, and I have messed with computers since the late 50s as a user, not as a developer or programmer.
Okay. Yep.
And it seems to me, I want to take issue with a thing, one of the comments made early in the program that we're getting smarter all of the time. And I really don't think that's the case. My father was a teacher, and his classes could add two-digit numbers, a column of five or six of them in their heads. Today, my daughter is a teacher, and children can't add anything at all without a handheld computer.
So you're thinking computers may be getting smarter, but humans themselves may be, through lack of exercise, getting dumber.
Exactly. That's exactly my comment is that the human is inherently lazy, and whenever we transfer to somebody else to do something, we ourselves lose something.
That is interesting. Let us pick it up, George. Jan, how about it? I mean, after all, computers aren't the only malleable plastic things. So are we. As computers gain intelligence, do you think we'll lose it? Are we doing that already to George's example?
Well, you know, is it a bad thing to, you know, arguably perhaps the fact that we now have, we can wear glasses makes our vision worse because we don't exercise our eyes. So, you know, there are arguments that have been made like this by old generations that progress of technology makes certain abilities disappear, and it's just a fact of life. But, you know, young people are comfortable with new technology that older people aren't, and you know, it's just a new set of abilities that are being acquired by young people, or interest, or the focus of our intelligence moves around. But in fact, what
well, we hope so. We hope it's not just a net loss or just a new dependence.
No, it's not a net loss. Well, in fact, what I think is that if machines do things very well, usually they tend to replace us for things that humans are not particularly good at. And so that allows us to concentrate on things that are uniquely human, you know, human emotions, poetry, things like that that computers don't really do. I think it's actually positive in some ways.
We'll all be spouting.
Of course, there are risks attached to that.
Right. But we'll all be spouting poetry. Who's going to make the living? Mark writes to us with such enthusiasm, our obsolescence as workers is ensured. I don't know. Mufti in Buffalo, New York. Mufti, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I'm a physician, and, you know, I had a comment and a question.
Yes.
You know, already we are seeing, like, for example, in the EKGs that we do, and, you have computer interpretations for the same. And some of the interpretations are pretty close. So my question to the panel is, are we looking at, like, computers interpreting radiological data, like CT scans, MRIs, for the physician, so that, you know, those things can be done in a timely manner, or are we looking at, replacing the radiologist, perhaps?
Yeah, let us pick it up. Thank you, Mufti. Peter Norvig, this is not a line worker in an auto plant, replaced by a robot. This is a physician with all that education, human education under his belt, and here their radiology results are being read by computer, and he's not so sure about, his role down the road. What do you say, Peter?
I think that computer is a tool for the radiologist, and it may be doing more, may be highlighting some areas and say, here, take a look at this. This seems like the key area to look at. But I think for a long time, we're still going to want the physician to be making the final call.
Medicine's pretty expensive. I mean, all kinds of things could weigh against that. Just economics could say, well, for a lot of people, the computer reading is going to have to do. We can't afford to have all these doctors doing it.
Well, I think that we make the doctor able to work faster and still be just as good, or maybe give them more time to spend time with the patient because they're less time staring at the x-rays.
Here's a comment from a listener. Yar says, any free-thinking non-human intelligence would quickly come to the conclusion that humans are destructive and would then act to eliminate them from the environment given the chance. Well, there's Kubrick's and everybody else's kind of Hollywood dystopia coming back again. What do you say? The humans have this feeling of the inevitability of that. What do you say to it, Peter?
I guess that's not the scenario that I worry about. Let's leave that to the science fiction people. I think we do need to do a good job of making sure that our complicated computer systems are safe and reliable. I'm not so worried about evil robots taking over the world, but I am worried about the complications and inadvertent errors as we trust computers to do more. As an industry, we haven't done that good of a job. We're.
Do you mean with power supplies and that sort of thing, or something?
Yeah, just in general, in terms of computer security and so on, we've really focused on convenience and making it cheaper to buy new things, and not on assuring that they're of the highest quality. And maybe we're at a point now where we have to go back and say, let's redesign things a little to make sure they're a little bit safer and more secure.
Jan, it sounds like you'll be hustling on down the road in developing more AI while Peter works on reliability and security.
That's quite possible. I leave that to him.
You guys are great to bring this world and open it up to we lay folk on the outside who dip in often and richly these days to the internet in a million other ways, but don't always understand what's going on under the covers. Deep learning right now. Jan LeCun, professor of computer science, neuroscience, electrical, and computer engineering at New York University. It's very good of you to spend this hour with us, Jan. Thank you so much for your insights.
Well, thanks for having me.
And Peter Norvig, a director of research at Google. Terrific to have you with us today, Peter. Good luck there. Do it right. Do it securely. Do it reliably. Thanks for joining us, Peter.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, in this hour tomorrow, we're going to be talking about irony. We're going to hear a case against irony. It is kind of the pose of hipness. It is very big. We'll have an author who says it may keep us from living a full life. And we'll hear the pushback as well. Thanks for joining us today on AI. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.